for the mindfulness is on one thing, very clear, very sharp, but it doesn't move at all. And it brings eventually what the Buddha said, it reaches its peak in the fourth jhana. That's the peak of mindfulness, where with complete equanimity you're just fully aware of just one thing. Fully aware, unmoving. And that's as powerful a mindfulness as the mind can have. Once you know that type of mindfulness, then you just, you know how even ridiculous it is to think you can become enlightened without jhanas. Without that powerful mindfulness, you can't get the powerful insights. So you begin to realize for yourself what mindfulness can be and the sort of mindfulness which you need to become enlightened. The powerful ones are the ones which will dig deeply into the nature of things, not the coarse ones. So you do actually notice there are many different levels of mindfulness, and mindfulness isn't just one little thing which is there in daily life and which is the same in deep meditation, and there's only one type of mindfulness. Know that mindfulness has so many different degrees of power and subtlety and penetration. There are many types of knives, blunt ones and sharp ones, and all in between. It's just like mindfulness. So this is what mindfulness is in Buddhism, in meditation. How to develop it, and how to make it very sharp and very strong, and how eventually to get that mindfulness which you can use to dig deep into the nature of your mind and uncover the beautiful treasures of anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. It's amazing you say those words, the great treasures of Buddhism, and people think they can't be treasures. How can suffering be a treasure? How can impermanence? We want something really marvellous and uplifting, like beauty, like transcendence, like cosmic consciousness, like the essence of all being. This is why people don't find the treasures, because they don't know what they're looking for. Anyway, that's the talk on mindfulness. Anyone got any questions about that this morning? When you're tired and you expend energy, is there a chance you might just put too much energy forth and just end up going to sleep because you're tired? This is where you become very skillful as a meditator, because sometimes you get really tired and you put really a lot of energy in and tiredness completely disappears and you're just awake all night. You're just buzzing all night. And this, as a monk, you play around with things like this and you find out just sometimes just how much of a con man or con woman the mind is. So I'm really sleepy, I really need some sleep. And you call its bluff, I'm not going to sleep. And you find out what the mind can actually do. And it's amazing what this mind can do. You can be, all the reasons in the world why you should be tired, you've been working all day, it's been hot, you know, you haven't had enough food. You know, you've been a bit sick. So what? You sit there and you get incredible energy up. And then you really start to wonder about this body and this mind, just how it deceives you. And you can sit sort of perfectly clear for many hours. If you know that you can do that, then you can play around with these things. However, there's other times you realise that, you know, you are tired and you just haven't got what it takes to sort of to overcome that hindrance. So then you go and have a rest. This is where you get very skillful on to know when to fight your battles and when just to go and retreat. But don't always retreat. Every now and again, so stand your ground and just see what you can do. I think it's good fun, especially when you win. Yeah, mindfulness and concentration. The concentration, what's meant by concentration, is like the sustained mindfulness. It is when it's a type of mindfulness which is that subtle and that peaceful, it just lingers on its object, but doesn't go anywhere else. So this is a very beautiful way of describing that which we mean by concentration, that which is really useful, to be able to sustain your attention on something. And that's what you're training at in this meditation. You want to sustain your attention in the present moment. The important word is sustain it. It's easy to be aware in the present moment for a couple of seconds, but to sustain it for a whole hour, it takes a lot of practice and skill. It's easy to be aware of the breath, but to sustain attention on the breath for a long time. Actually, it's not that hard to get up a samadhi nimitta, but to sustain your attention on it for long enough for it to do its work and get you into a jhana, that's what's the skill of meditation. And if you can want to be wise, to look at the mind and sustain your attention on it without moving, so you really see anatta, non-self, that's a difficult one, because people's minds just wander off too much and they can't really keep on one thing long enough to fully understand it. When they're looking, they're not really looking, they're talking about it. When you're talking about something, you're not seeing it. So that's why that people never actually get to see the truth. Is it possible to have concentration without mindfulness? You have to have some degree of mindfulness, but you can be sort of like concentrated, say, on the television. It's a thing which comes to my mind. So you're sustaining your attention on there, but there's not really much attention sort of present which you're sustaining. And you know that there's not much mindfulness there if you can't really remember what you did. Now, this is a common question in meditation teachers. Some of you have been asked this question before. Do you remember where your shoes are when you came into this hall? Which way are they pointing? Nice little question there, because so often these little things, we take off our shoes or we put them at the doorway there without really paying attention, and that means we can't remember which way they're pointing. If you took them off with attention, with full mindfulness, you'd remember exactly where they are right now, which direction they're pointing, whether they're parallel or skewed or whatever. And it just shows us just how very often that we don't practice mindfulness and we don't remember. It's the same as you're watching the television. You may have concentration there, you're sustaining your attention on it, but people ask you what happened. Well, I'm not really quite sure. Unless it was very exciting, then you might remember exactly what happened. But so often, so much of life. What did you eat for breakfast this morning? What did you eat first? What did you eat last? If you had full attention, you'd be able to recall completely what you ate and how you ate it. This is the difference between mindfulness and concentration. And how you can know if it's mindfulness, because you can remember, you can recall. The gatekeeper, the instructions of the gatekeeper, you can make those instructions up yourself, because if you make the instructions up, it's harder for you to do, therefore you remember them much easier. If I give them to you, it's just too easy, and you find it's not as powerful as if you put the instructions in your own words to the gatekeeper each stage. That's why sometimes that we give guided meditation. You know, you've been to Nalamala, give the guided meditation, say, right now to watch the present moment, just be aware of the present moment. It's nowhere near as powerful as if you say that for yourself, clearly and deeply. Because I'm just doing it all for you. It's just like being a, almost like in the dog training camp, sit, walk, sit. Now stand, So that's nowhere near as powerful as if you're training yourself. Because sometimes people say that, oh, you can come to Nalambara and I can get quiet. When I go home, I just can't do it. Because you're not developing your own mindfulness, your own strength. Yeah, it's an interesting point that you're saying about in the first days of meditation, awareness in the present moment, you know, chatter. A lot of times chatter is about the past or about the future. However, that you can just take the chattering itself as the object of your attention. It's just, I'm chattering now. And so you just know the chattering as it's occurring. So you're fully listening to the chattering. And that becomes the object of your attention. As long as it's right now, this is an experience which is happening right now. It's in a thought, it's in a chatter, and I'm just going to watch it. Indeed, yes, sometimes you say that if you watch the chatter, you get caught up with it and get caught along with it. But there is that way of just actually standing back from the chatter and just like watching it with a sense of like distance from it. As if it's like an object. As if it's not you chattering, you just listen to someone else chattering. And this is actually that perspective of mindfulness where you're watching as if it were through a window. You're not actually right there in the action. It's like the sort of mindfulness which you're watching like a movie. You know, you're in the seats and the people may be killing one another or they may be doing all sorts of things. But you always remember that you're just in the seat, you're watching all of this. So there's a sense of like detaching from what you're watching, a separation. If you do that, you don't get caught up with it. However, if you start to attach to what you're seeing, how that manifests is that when someone gets shot, you jump out of your seat, or when the alien comes into the screen, you go ooh, or you shriek or whatever. You really get caught up with the action on the screen. You forget there's even a screen there. The edges of the screen all disappear. You may be sitting in an armchair, you don't know you're sitting in an armchair, it's as if you're right there in the action. Just the skill of the movie makers has transported you from the comfortable seat in the movie theatre, you know, into the jungles of, is it Jurassic Park or whatever it was? You actually think you're right there. And that's when you've lost of your mindfulness. So if you're watching the thought, always that keep that distance and separation. You're watching from the place, you know, in your mind, which is separated from that thought. So it's just, oh, this is an interesting thought, but you don't get caught along with it. You watch it as if it was somebody else's thought. As if it's just like words, sounds, just rolling through the screen of the mind. Does that make any sense? Actually, on that sort of that metaphor of a movie screen, that sometimes that if you put what you're experiencing, imagine it as on a movie screen. So one of the beautiful ways of developing meditation is to always remember that the movie screen always has a centre to it. That's where you're paying most of your attention. Because like the characters on a movie, there may be three or four characters and all sorts of the extras around the back. You're always like centre on the main character. And you find if you're watching the television or watching a movie, you find that when you're watching the main character on the centre of the screen there, the flower pot on top of your television after a while disappears. You can't see it. The controls on the side disappear. And in your vision, what you're actually aware of is just the screen. Actually, not even the edges of the screen, just the center of the screen. And you're not aware of anything on the edge of that experience. That's all disappeared. That's all fallen off the screen. And this is actually what you can do in meditation. If, for example, you're aware of the present moment, past and future may be on the outside of the screen, but center on the present moment. And then after a while, just the past and the future will have fallen off the screen. Just like the controls or the flower pot on top of the television. Literally falls away from your attention. And then if it's the silent awareness of the present moment, you can put silence in the middle and all the thoughts on the outside. And then eventually, if you're really focusing on the silence, you're keeping that in the centre of your screen, all the thinking, the chatter will eventually fall off. You won't see it anymore, just like the flower pot. And you can put the breath in the third state at the centre of your screen. And anything else, the sounds outside, aches and pains in the body, itches, put that on the edge. But always keep the breath at the centre of your screen. And after a while you find all those things, as your mindfulness focuses in and in, all those other things disappear. They're gone. Just the same way as things disappear from around the television screen. And this is how you can actually focus in onto things. However, if you're watching the breath and there's a sound of, say, like a helicopter in the distance, and if you put that in the centre of the screen, the helicopter sound, then you find the breath falls off the edge of the screen. You've lost your mindfulness. You've lost the object of attention. So that's a really nice simile, that centering on the meditation object in the centre of your screen. And it works very, very well. Now, Ajahn, sometimes in deep meditation, a jolt goes through my body, but there's no drowsiness or sleepiness. What is that? Okay, that a lot of times drowsiness is sometimes hidden. Sometimes you don't know you're drowsy. And that's one of the problems there for meditators, is very often that sloth and torpor is this misty state. And you think you're peaceful, but actually you are sort of drowsy. And other people will tell you that you've been nodding or you've been sort of slumping. But you yourself very often don't notice it. And it's amazing sometimes that even when I was a young monk, I had terrible trouble with drowsiness and sloth and torpor. And going to sleep when you're meditating. And some would tell me I spent the whole hour nodding, and I couldn't believe them. I said, no way, I was nice and peaceful. Yeah, you were nice and peaceful, all right. And it was like pride sort of refused to admit that. And so that's when I did things like putting matchboxes on top of my head, you know, without the cover on. And sure enough, they fell off, but I was drowsy. And very often it's just when you catch yourself is that a jolt comes through the body very often. However, that's not always the case with drowsiness. There's another case of what comes up is not really drowsiness, but still the mindfulness isn't sharp. It's usually explained as that the objects which you're meditating on, which you're trying to be aware of, gets really refined, but the attention doesn't get refined enough to keep track of it. It's as if like the tracker, the attention, is like following this animal, which is hunting the meditation object. And the animal, it can be very clever and can slip away down a corridor or under a bush, and you realize you've lost it. And the mindfulness has to get sharp very quickly to try and find it again. There's just a mindfulness, the attention isn't refined enough to keep up, and suddenly there's like a nothingness there. You've lost everything, and it sort of wakes you up a bit. And sometimes that is a jolt there, as if like mindfulness following its object just loses track of it and has to come into line very quickly, and that's a jolt. There's also other jolts come up when you've got very good mindfulness and you're watching the object of meditation, all right. You're not that deep in meditation, but sometimes it's just like tensions in the body sort of release themselves, and sometimes that's the jolt which comes out. There's some sort of suppression or some sort of tightness there which has locked itself in part of your body, and just without you being able to do anything, suddenly it's sort of like a tick or an involuntary movement of the body. You're perfectly aware. You can see it before, you can see it afterwards, but it's just something the body does. And if that's the case, if there is some involuntary movement of the body at certain stages in the meditation, ignore it, don't make a big problem out of it, don't think too much about it, and it will just pass away by itself, if it's that type of meditation problem. If it recurs a few times, then in order to stop this becoming a habit in your meditation, just do things slightly differently. If it's you're sitting in full lotus, sit in half lotus. Very often little changes like that are enough to stop the habit patterns sort of becoming ingrained. Just doing things slightly differently. And those of you who've heard me teach before, get like in a habit, so bad habits of meditation. Even if every time you start to meditate you sort of go sleepy, then just changing the way you do things slightly makes enormous difference. And I haven't taught this here yet, but many of you have been practicing this anyway, because I taught this on previous retreats, doing counting. Breathing in one, breathing out one, breathing in two, breathing out two. And if that doesn't work, then you change it around. Breathing out one, breathing in one. Breathing out two, breathing in two. Breathing out three, breathing in three. Just you change it, instead of starting the counting at the in-breath, you start at the out-breath. It's amazing just what a difference that makes. Because it just means the mind is seeing the same thing. It wakens them up, stops it getting into these habits, is the results. And if you need to like a habit, a voluntary movement, which could keep on happening, just change your medicine slightly like that. If you put your lap like this, fold your hands, or do something else with your hands, a slightly different posture of the body can sometimes stop that becoming a repeated activity in the meditation. So these are like the three types of jolts which can come through the body. One is the jolt of it really is drowsiness but you're not noticing it. The second one is where the object of meditation gets very peaceful but the mindfulness is not sharp enough to keep up with it. And it's got a sort of suddenly sort of leap towards the object. And the third one is this involuntary tics or movements of the body which come because of some sort of tightness or tension locked into the body. Well, with that one, just make sure it doesn't become a habit. Just by one, not worrying about it, concerning yourself about it, just leave it alone. It'll disappear by itself. And if it doesn't disappear pretty quickly in your meditation, three or four meditations, it doesn't disappear, then just try doing things slightly differently. When I hear a loud noise in stage three or stage four of the meditation process, I will react strongly, i.e. jump. Please advise ways to help me overlook these noises completely. Thank you. One of those skillful means which I've been talking about in the interviews and I mentioned during one of the talks is on stage three or stage four when you're watching the breath, look upon the image in your mind as a screen, like a movie screen or a TV screen, and put the breath at the center of your screen. And if there's any other noises, any other feelings in the body, any other thoughts, you can allow them on the screen, but make sure they're not at the center. The center of the screen will be your breath. Because what you put in the center of your screen, in your mind, that will remain as the mind just focuses down. All that's on the edge will start to disappear in exactly the same way. When you're watching the television, or the picture on top of the television, or the video cassettes underneath the television, they all disappear from your field of view as you focus in on the action. And sometimes even the characters on the edge of the screen there you don't see, you're looking at the characters in the center. And it's amazing if you watch the television that you find out you've got no idea the edge of the screen. You don't know whether the screen is circular or square when you're really into watching the television, because the edge disappears completely as you focus in on the center. So if you focus in on the center and keep the center as the breath, then the noises will go to the edge. And you'll experience the noises will be so far on the edge, even the loud noise, you can just about hear it, but it's as if it's a long way away. then you don't jump. Jumping, what happens there is when the sound becomes the center of your screen. And you're not watching the breath, you're watching the sound. The breath isn't established well enough in the center. But if you're on stage 3 or stage 4 and you've really established the breath in the center of your screen, then the sound comes and it's just on the edge, out there somewhere. You always wander off when whatever is your distraction, say it's like a pain in your or like a mozzie buzzing in your ear, and once that becomes the centre of your screen, then that's the only thing you know, and the breath falls off the edge of the screen. You don't know where the breath is, but you know where the mozzie is. And this is what happens when you don't keep your meditation object in the centre of the screen. So it's a very good metaphor to use in the meditation in order to make sure that any distractions, you can have them in the meditation at the beginning part of stage 3 or the beginning part of stage 4, but you've got them in a place where they'll eventually disappear, leaving the breath by itself. They're on the edge of the screen rather than the center. When there is a lot of energy in my mind during meditation, I get a sensation of flashing in my mind. How is this different from the more powerful sensation of a samadhi nimitta? Could you please compare them? Ta. When there's a lot of energy in my mind during meditation, I get a sensation of flashing in my mind. What can be happening there is when the mind does begin to be peaceful, and the mind does appear, sometimes because the energy is too coarse, you can't hold that nimitta. Just the mindfulness is not refined enough. I mentioned this before. To be able to get a nimitta and to hold it so you can sustain attention, you have to be very, very peaceful. Very, very quiet indeed. And the mindfulness has to be that sharp that it can live in peacefulness and without disturbing it. It's like if something is very, very peaceful, like say this meditation hall here, and some sort of ruffian comes from outside, straight away they disturb everything. And you can't keep the peace here. Sometimes that's what our mind is like. It sort of comes into peacefulness, disturbs it all. It's just too rough and too coarse. It needs to be trained much further to become more refined. It's like a bull in a china shop. So this is sometimes what happens. A little bit of peace flashes into the mind there, but the mindfulness is just too coarse, which is why it's hard work, I realise this, and everyone wants to get on to the nice fun stuff, samadhi nimittas and all the jhanas and all stuff like that. But you have to make a very strong foundation for yourself. You have to spend a lot of days just really working just with simple things like present moment awareness, like silence, like just being with the breath for hour after hour, or rather meditation after meditation period, and build up the subtlety of mindfulness. And then if you really get these foundations really, really well built up, when a nimitta does come and the mind is peaceful, you find you can hold it. It's not done through willpower, it's done through training. Just like a person can want to sort of be the best tennis player and just think, oh, I can hit it over the net just like anyone else. But it takes so much training to be able to be skillful. And this is with meditation. Train, train, train. To the point when a nimitta comes up and you can just be perfectly mindful without disturbing it. And the nimitta stays, and so does mindfulness. And then you're really laughing. This is what happens here. The energy is sometimes good. You need energy to get into deep jhanas. But the energy needs to be managed. needs to be managed by this ability just to not disturb anything. Basically, the thing which disturbs is the doer. And I've mentioned this so many times in this retreat already, but you only really understand what I mean is when you get into this area of meditation and it keeps on falling apart until you realize what actually is making it fall apart. And it's this thing we call the doer. Once it disappears, then you know what it is. When it's always there, you can't really understand what it is. Only when it goes, the doer disappears, and you're in very peaceful states, then you realize, ah, that was the doer. That was what Ajahn Brahm has been on about all this time. It's only then you really find out what I mean by a doer. When it disappears. Because something which is always here, it's like having the fans on. You always have the buzz of the fans. And it's only when you turn them off, you realize, oh, the fan was on. Because the buzz disappears. So the buzz of the doer, always buzzing about. When that sort of disappears, the buzz goes. And only then you realize, oh, that was what the doer was. Buzz off. Okay, can you get the samadhi nimitta just by forcing the issue, say, just, I want to get it now, come on? Basically, no. The only exception to that is if you've had a very nice meditation very recently. You've had like a nimitta coming up, you've gone into a jhana. When it's like fresh to your mind, then you can just very gently say, come back. With great gentleness, and then very often it will come back. You'll just be able to turn to it because it's fresh in your memory. If you do a lot of jhana meditation, that's how you can very easily get back in there again. Just avert to the nimitta. There was apparently one monk, I was told, who was doing a lot of jhana meditation, that even when he would be travelling down to wherever at night time in one of the buses, because they'd always put the monks up the front of the buses in Thailand. They did that because, like insurance, they thought, well, at least the monks have got so much good karma that they can't die, or they're much likely to die than the rest of us. So they put them in the front to protect everyone in the back. I remember them doing that to me once, going from Chonburi in Thailand to Bangkok. And because I was in the front there, especially like a Western monk is supposed to be especially fortunate. And so this driver, just, I was terrible being in the front, because you could see just all the traffic coming towards you. And you know, he literally was driving and had the video on the television. And he was just looking at the video and just pushing his hands up and down. He wasn't worrying where he was going. Fortunately, I did have enough good karma because he didn't crash. If it wasn't his driving saved him, that's for sure. But anyhow, that this particular monk, when he was in the front of the buses, he looked like headlights coming towards him. That would just remind his mind of a samadhi nimitta, and you just sort of go into jhanas. Just that, the visual effect of a headlight would just trigger off. The mind will just do the rest. So if you do a lot, you become very sensitive to nimittas, and you can bring them up. But that's only if you've done a lot of jhanas. You can't just, if you haven't done any jhanas yet, or you've only won a couple of years ago, then there's no way that all the willing in the world is the last thing you want to do. Be quiet, just rest, relax. Be quiet, don't do anything. Make your room as peaceful and as beautiful as possible. And if your room, your mind, is really just really well set up, it's just so peaceful, so quiet, so still, then you don't need to go looking for jhanas. Jhanas will come and visit you by themselves. If your room isn't peaceful, isn't tidy, isn't well set up, then you can go looking all you like. The jhanas will never come in, because they don't like rooms like that. Okay, you're asking that sort of, when you're sort of working hard at your meditation, is it good to do shorter stints or longer stints? It's this is where you really got to experiment and see what works for you. what the best thing to do is always that if the meditation is going good, then carry on. If it's a half an hour and it's still going good, carry on. If it's an hour, carry on. If it's 2 hours, carry on. If it's time for lunch, carry on meditating. You can have lunch at another time if you're having a really good meditation. Other times, if it's really, really hopeless, then you can really get up. Sometimes it's really, really hopeless, just sit there for the hell of it. Because if you just always move when it's hopeless, sometimes you don't build up any endurance. And sometimes the mind can be very tricky. Sometimes you think it's hopeless. Sometimes you're in great agony and pain, and you think, this is really stupid me meditating here. And sometimes you say, I don't believe you, mind. And you carry on, you get into deep meditation in the next 5 minutes. This mind is very strange and very weird until you really know its ways and its tricks. And the mind is full of tricks. It'll do anything to stop you getting into deep meditation sometimes. The reason is because to get into deep meditation, you've got to give up something which sometimes deep down you don't really want to. That's why I keep on saying it's bliss, it's wonderful, just to overcome that fear, that attachment, which stops you attaining these stages. Okay, so next question. Ajahn, how do you let go of the body? How you let go of the body is a couple of ways. One is just realizing just what a pain this body is. I mean, some of you know already, but some of you don't know. Some of you think you know, but not fully. It's a great difficulty, this body. It's always aching and always needs to be fed. You know, I have to feed it 2 or 3 times a day. And this is, wouldn't it be wonderful? Don't you think it would be wonderful if you could just have some sort of pill, some slow-release pill? So you just had to put it in your mouth once a week. And you wouldn't have to worry about sort of going to the kitchens and cooking and eating and washing up and all this bother about food. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you just had like one pill a week and that would have a slow release of all the vitamins and proteins and energies? Or not? Or do you like eating? You see what happens with this body? It's just—it's not just for sustenance. It's just it gets into all these attachments and desires and delights. And this body is also very sensitive. Just little mosquitoes can cause all sorts of irritations to this body. Tiny bacteria in your stomach can cause all sorts of trouble to you. So the first thing is to realize that this body is just a mass of irritation, basically. So the first thing is like, so don't be too interested in it, and don't worship this body. The trouble with our society, we do worship the body. What a wonderful body this is. And when things go wrong, we think that it's a mistake, the body goes wrong. It's natural, it's normal, it's part of nature that the body decays and eventually falls apart in death. It's part of nature that things start to wear out, just like a car or any other machine. Towards the end of its life, things go wrong. You only get sort of how many years warranty on a car? 5 years or 10 year warranty? That's really all you get on your body, really. Maybe 30 years warranty, that's about all. And after that, things start to go wrong. So that's the first thing to let go of the body, is just realize there's no vested interest in keeping attention on it. And then when you meditate, little by little, let go of bits of it. So you let go of all the past and the future of your body. Because it's not this body here you have to let go of. It's all the bodies you've had since you've been born. It's all the bodies you'll have until you'll die. All those bodies as well you have to let go of. Because sometimes that's difficult to do when you've got an ache or a pain. The real problem is not the body experiencing the pain now, but the body which will experience the pain the next moment, and the body which will experience the pain a minute from now. And all the bodies which will experience that pain until you die. You have to let go of all those bodies. And all that happened to you in your past, your earlier experiences, when you were abused, when you were hurt, when you were told off, or whatever, you have to let go of all those bodies as well. So don't be a busy body, just be a nobody. Get rid of all these bodies. And when you actually let go of all these bodies, you can imagine them in a great line, from the time you were born until the time you die. All different stages, just in a huge line, and you're carrying all of them on top of your head. At least let go of the bodies of the past and the future. At least let go of the bodies of your imagination and fantasies created by thought. And then when you get onto the breath, you're letting go of every other part of your body other than the breath. Yeah, your feet, your legs, your bottom, your arms, your hands, your chest, your head, your ears, your nose, everything except the breath. That's all that's left. And then you let go of the breath. When you let go of the breath, you let go of the last part of your body. When you're not aware of your body, when the mindfulness is somewhere else, you've let go of the body. And you feel so free. When this body, there's no aches, there's no pains, there's no mosquito bites, there's no heat, there's no cold, there's no pain at all, because the mind is with the mind and it's not playing around in this body. Very similar to anyone who has an out of the body experience. As soon as you leave your body, you feel a great sense of relief and freedom and lightness. You come back again, heavy old body again. So that's how you learn how to let go of the body. One of the problems is, in meditation, you get to a certain stage, you're about to let go of the body, but you don't want to. That's when you're concerned about the aches and the pains, you're concerned about the sounds. You always ask yourself, why am I listening to the aches and pains in the body? Why am I listening to the sounds outside? Because you're just being overprotective of your body. After a while, you trust the body to look after the body. It's quite safe here, and you can just put all your attention on the mind. Your breathing, let the body do the breathing. Any saliva in your mouth, let the body swallow it if it wants to. Don't you do anything. Don't you give any suggestions at all to the body. That's how you let go of the body. And it disappears. And disappears. Great. Bit of peace. Okay, the next question. Ajahn, can you please explain the difference between right mindfulness and right concentration in the Noble Eightfold Path? In particular, could you please explain the role of each of those factors in samatha meditation and the attainment of jhanas? Right mindfulness and right concentration in the Noble Eightfold Path. The right mindfulness and right concentration, the samma samadhi, is always like the jhanas in the Noble Eightfold Path. To enable you to get those jhanas, you have to overcome the five hindrances. And to be able to get the right mindfulness, which will see the true Dhamma, it has to be mindfulness which isn't weakened by the five hindrances. When you have mindfulness which is free from the five hindrances, it's mindfulness which can stay on its object. Mindfulness which isn't looking for the objects of a sensory desire. It's not restless. It's not sort of clouded through sloth and torpor. And it's not wobbling all over the place through doubt. It's powerful mindfulness, stable mindfulness, because it's mindfulness born of concentration, born of samadhi. When you have deep samadhi and you come out afterwards, you know what I mean. The quality of mindfulness after jhanas is just so strong, you understand why it's called right mindfulness or perfect mindfulness or strong mindfulness or great mindfulness. is that's the mindfulness which you can apply to, as in the Satipatthana, to the body, your body, to see it's not yours. Use it up to Vedana, feeling, perception or consciousness, objects of mind. All of these you can put the mindfulness on, and then you can truly see that none of this belongs to you. All that you called the body and mind, none of it is yours. None of it belongs to you. None of it is a self. You've been worrying and dealing with something which is part of nature, not part of you. You give to nature what belongs to nature. What you keep for yourself, there's actually nothing left. So you've got no business anymore. You can retire.